features that are most important, you shouldn't really buy a dehydrator if it doesn't have these, is a temperature control and a fan. If you don't have that, you really have a cheap unit that you're going to have very mixed results from.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. This is episode 126. Our guest is Glenn, or as we like to call him, the Backpacking Chef. He has a site by that name, and on that site he lists many recipes and techniques and all kinds of information that you need to know if you want to prepare your own food for backcountry meals. A good portion of this conversation focuses on dehydrating techniques. If you don't have a dehydrator, but maybe you're interested, we also cover how to choose a dehydrating unit. I've mentioned in the past that dehydrating is something I've been doing for a while now. It's my alternative to Mountain House and the other prepared meals that are out there. With a dehydrator, I know exactly what I'm eating. I know what goes into it, and I can make whatever I want, whenever I want it. Best of all, it's easy to rehydrate that food in the backcountry, and it tastes great. So if you want to prepare your own meals from the backcountry, this is definitely going to be a great episode for you to listen to. Speaking of food and nutrition, hope you guys caught our recent episode with Kyle Camp from V2P Nutrition. Don't forget that we have a backcountry fuel guide with nutrition strategy and an example meal plan just for you guys. All you got to do is go to exomountaingear.com/nutrition and you can download that guide for free, as many of you have already done. And hope you enjoy it and find great benefit from it. Finally, before we dive into this episode, I wanted to give a shout out for some iTunes reviews and podcast feedback that we've gotten. I haven't been great about pulling reviews, or at least sending them on the air publicly, and I got called off for it, and I love it. I'm glad you guys keep me accountable. So Steve Phillips, Drew Adams, and Austin Ledbetter, we want to send you some Exo Mountain Gear and Hunt Backcountry swag. Send us your shipping information to podcasts@exomountaingear.com. We will get you guys taken care of. Listeners, if you want to be entered into these giveaways, it's real simple. Just leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you might be listening to this. Or contact us with your questions, suggestions, or topics for this show by email. Just send us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Okay, let's get right into this episode with Chef Glenn. Glenn, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So you have a site. It's the Backpacking Chef. It's a site that I have run across many times over the years, just when I get to Googling different food ideas for trips and things like that. And then more recently, as I've got into dehydrating, it's been an awesome resource. Excited to have you on the show today to help us learn some things about trail cooking and dehydrating and related topics. But before we dive too deep into the topics, how did you become, quote-unquote, the backpacking chef?
Well, it all started back in 2008. I have been a hiker for many years, but started to get into backpacking. I wanted to stay out longer in the woods, and so things kind of came together, both starting into backpacking as well as an interest in eating healthy food. And so I decided that I would figure out how to make my own dried food as opposed to buying the freeze-dried meals from the store. I was a little bit health conscious, and I was a label reader, and so I was seeing some of the things that were going into some of these freeze-dried meals, and I just didn't really want to eat them on any kind of a regular basis. So I thought, well, I could just get a dehydrator and figure out how to do this on my own, and then make things that I like to eat that I knew were healthy, and still have the benefits of freeze-dried food, which is that it would be very lightweight and that it would be well-preserved and last a long time while I was out in the woods.
And then, so did you just kind of naturally start documenting recipes and things like that? And is that how the site got going?
It is. It was really, it started with a notebook. And I would just put the topic, you know, whatever I was working on, whatever food at the top. And I would just play around with that food and just document what the temperatures were, how long it took me to dry it, what it weighed before and what it weighed after, and measuring the volume. So I just kept really accurate notes as I went along. And once I had a fairly full notebook, then I started transferring that to the website, backpackingchef.com. And it just kind of grew. It just kind of developed a little bit at a time until it was more or less a complete website with all the different categories of dehydrating food.
Yeah, it's a fantastic resource to have. It's one of these things where I think dehydrating in general is a bit of trial and error, and there's always some variables there which we can talk about, but I'll tell you what, having a resource like your site has been super helpful for me as I've gotten into this.
Have you tried the chili yet?
This is one I want to talk about. Chili. Chili's an interesting one. I've looked at your chili recipe, and then I have not made that specifically yet. But what I have done is taken kind of our just standard normal chili recipe that we love in our home with our family.
Exactly.
And
right,
dehydrated
right.
that. Which yep. brings me to a question I was going to talk about later, but let's go ahead and do it now. So what I do with the chili is just cook it normal and then just double the batch or make extra and then just dehydrate it complete. And so that's one strategy. And then one thing that we'll talk about here in a bit in the show is taking individual components, like just dehydrating meat or just dehydrating some beans or just dehydrating some potatoes, and then kind of assembling a meal from dehydrated ingredients. Yeah, are there advantages and disadvantages to taking a complete cooked meal and dehydrating that versus dehydrating specific ingredients and then combining those dried ingredients?
Yeah, I mean, you can go either way. There's nothing wrong with either approach. So if you have especially like a chili, my recipe is on the website and in the book, it's fine to just dehydrate the whole meal, and you can make several servings of it, or you can just make it for dinner and just dehydrate your leftovers. So, it's very easy and convenient to just dehydrate a whole meal. And chili works out great because, it's just basically your tomato base and your beef and your beans. So it's all ingredients that dehydrate well. With whole meals, the one thing that you would want to avoid would be anything that is like cheesy. You know, say you wanted to do some sort of pasta meal with some sort of a sauce, you would want to avoid any of those vodka or three cheese type of sauces because the cheese is just not really going to dehydrate well. It's going to be greasy. So any kind of fat is really not going to dehydrate. So basically that fat's going to be quite present in the meal, and there's a potential risk of it going rancid over time. And so if you're dehydrating a whole meal, just go with things that have very, very little fat. You can get away with a little bit of olive oil, but minimize your use of oils in any kind of whole meal that you dry.
Okay.
So that would be the main thing. Then it's really just a matter of spreading it out. The thinner you spread it out on your dehydrator trays, the quicker it's going to dehydrate and the more efficiently. If you're using a variety of cuts of vegetables or meat, you'd want to try to be as uniform as possible. And then when you get down, say it's already been in the dehydrator 6 or 7 or 8 hours, you want to have a look at it. You might break it apart at that point with your fingers. And if you've got some larger pieces that are still a little moist on the inside, then you just basically tear or break those pieces into smaller pieces so that everything is completely dry. Because if you've dried a meal, but you left one little or a few little nuggets that weren't dry in there, and then potentially that could grow mold when you're wanting to eat it. So yeah, you just have to make sure that the whole thing dries completely.
I mean, you've mentioned some good tips in there already about fat. Fat is something that I wanted to talk about because it's kind of a known thing to stay away from, whether that's fatty meat or, as you mentioned, oils. So that's something to stay away from.
Cheese.
And cheese. Yeah, exactly. And then you mentioned trying to make cuts and sizes of food very uniform. So there's
fairly, if you can.
Yeah. So you're
evening with ground beef, you're really not going to.
Yeah. So you're evening out that dry time. You don't have very large
exactly
components and then small ones. Are there any other just off the cuff, since we mentioned those and talked about them, any other off the cuff tips, things to do, things to avoid, and then we'll get more specific here as we progress?
Well, I know you. We're probably going to talk about meat as a category, so we can. There is one major tip I could go ahead and give you now, as far as ground beef or any kind of ground meat like chicken or turkey. Mm-hmm. Typically, first of all, you cook ground beef before you dehydrate it. That makes it safe and it kills any kind of microbes that might be in it. So, you're always cooking the beef first. But what I found back when I was getting started and keeping that notebook was that if you just cook ground beef and dehydrate it, it's not going to rehydrate very well. It's going to stay kind of hard. People refer to it as gravel. And so I thought, well, there's got to be a better way to do this. And so I tried what I call the meatloaf principle, and I added fine breadcrumbs to the ground beef before I cooked it. And that gave it the necessary starch built right into the meat. And that starch is what helps it to rehydrate extremely well when you're cooking it on the trail. So for every pound and a quarter of ground beef that you use, what you would do is sprinkle in a half a cup of fine breadcrumbs. And you can add any other kind of seasonings at that time if you like as well. And if you do that, you're going to have wonderful ground beef in your meal.
Yeah. I've done it with and without, and I will say it makes a huge difference adding that breadcrumb when you go to rehydrate that meal, for sure.
It does.
Are you adding those breadcrumbs after you've cooked that ground meat or before?
No, before.
Okay.
You do it before you cook it. So basically you just work it into the meat like you were making a meatloaf.
Sure.
And so you could let it sit just a little bit. And then you just pull it apart into small pieces, fry it up in the frying pan till it's all browned and cooked through. And you can blot off, if you've got any grease, you can blot it off with paper towels.
Yeah, before we get too far, Glenn, I'd love to kind of back up and cover some basics as well, just for people who might not be familiar with dehydrating or dehydrators. Maybe they're looking to get into it. I know that some of our listeners are probably in that exact position. Let's talk about the dehydrator unit itself first.
Sure.
There's so many options out there. Literally, you could spend, $30 or $300. Just go ahead and kind of walk us through maybe some of the things to look for, some of the things to consider. Is it worth it to spend more, certain sizes that might be helpful, and any features that you would look for?
The two features that are most important that you shouldn't really buy a dehydrator if it doesn't have these is temperature control, so that you can set it for 95 to 100 or so for some things like herbs, and go up to as much as 165 if you happen to be doing raw meat for jerky. And so, you know, for vegetables you could be at the 125, or fruits you could be at the 135. So temperature control is a very important feature. Those that don't have it can tend to run too hot, and it will kind of lead to either over drying or uneven drying. The other thing is a fan. You've got to have a fan that moves the air around and basically evacuates the moist air from the dehydrator. So those two things, temperature control and a fan. If you don't have that, you really have a cheap unit that you're going to have very mixed results from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After that, you've got basically two types of dehydrators. One class is what I would call the stacking round dehydrators with the hole in the middle. The most common brand would be from Nesco. And typically, the Nesco dehydrators will have a lower price point to get started if you want to, you know, if you're just getting into it and you don't want to spend a huge amount of money. So depending on which model you choose, you might be getting into it at, say, $70 up to, say, $170. And those Nesco stacking dehydrators will come with usually four or five individual trays, and they stack one on top of the other. So with those, you've got this hole in the middle, which the kind of the air goes up through to create the circulation. And then if you want to check on the food on a tray, you basically have to take the whole thing off of that tray to have a look at it, which wasn't really a feature that I liked, having to take each tray off. The other style is what is the sliding in and out trays. So it's basically a front door. It's a box front door, and the trays slide in and out. And the most common brand for that is the Excalibur dehydrator, and that's the brand that I use. I like being able to slide and these are square trays. I like to be able to slide them in and out and have a look at the food, and it's real easy to do that. So the Excaliburs have a very good reputation. They're made in the USA. But they are a higher price point. And so for some people, they might say, well, I don't know how much food I'm going to really be dehydrating. That's a little bit more than I really wanted to spend for it. But if you're going to be dehydrating a lot of food, and you know, you're a regular hunter that's needs to carry meals into the backcountry, or a backpacker, it ends up being well worth it. The square trays, the Excalibur comes generally in either a 5 or a 9 tray unit. It's got excellent capacity. And the others, the Nesco, although it's a good starting point, with the round shape and the hole in the middle, the capacity per tray is going to be lower. So if you want to increase your capacity, you can buy additional trays separately. But when you get into that, once you start doing that, you end up spending as much as an Excalibur by the time you've added several new trays. So, but again, if you're just going to dehydrate once in a while, you know, they're good little units.
Yeah, I went through that. It was an interesting decision for me, because I was looking at, as you mentioned, kind of the Nesco's, and oh, I can spend, you know, $80 and it has decent reviews. Mm-hmm. But then I got to thinking about it, and it was something that I knew I wanted to do long term, and I knew I wanted to do permanently. So I just went ahead and ponied up and got an Excalibur, and I don't regret it in the least, because it's having the capacities.
Works well for you.
Yeah, having the capacity is great. The adjustments are good. As you mentioned, not having to remove all those stacked trays and just being able to access things easier has been awesome. So, I mean, it's definitely not saying it's the only way to go, but I think if you are committed to doing this, it's certainly worth the consideration for sure.
Yeah. One other thing about that square shape of the tray, if you want to do anything liquidy, what I call making bark, things that you run through a blender, it's real easy to spread that thinly on the Excalibur trays. All you have to have is a nonstick sheet on there. And so works well for that too.
Awesome. So just another common question. How do you actually tell when something's done? I mean, I know it depends on what you are dehydrating, but are you literally just looking to go, there's no moisture in here, I think this is good? Because I've seen it, and I've had people contact me now that they know I've been dehydrating, and that's one of their most common questions is, how can I actually tell when this stuff is finished and dehydrated and can be taken out?
I guess, you know, if you buy a good dehydrating book, it'll give you the general time at a certain temperature when things will be dry. But there's usually a pretty big range in there based on the dehydrator you're using, or even the environment that you're using it in, if you're in a very humid area or whatever. So, I mean, you can really have a range of a variance of 4 or 5 hours. But it's not that hard, really, to tell when something's dry. I pretty much do it by feel, with just feeling it with my fingers, maybe pulling something apart, tearing it, and just, visual. So I can just really tell that it's dry. You definitely should not see any liquid or feel any moisture in it. As far as meats go, they're just obviously going to be dry, and they may even be brittle depending on the meat that you're drying. Other things, it might be a little trickier because they're going to be pliable. Say like bell peppers or something like that. They're not going to snap. They're going to be bendable, or what they call pliable. But there's not going to be any juiciness. So if you like squeezed it, there's nothing going to come out, even though it'll be bendable somewhat like leather. Mm-hmm. Vegetables will tend to be crispy. They're going to be drier than dried fruits. So fruits could be the trickiest one. They've got a higher sugar content, and so they're always going to be more pliable than the vegetables. But I think it's just a matter of experience. Once you've just tried it a little bit, you'll just know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I agree for sure. It's one of those things that when I started, I was super worried about getting it right or being perfect.
Yeah, and I hear from a lot of people that they are concerned. They don't want it to spoil. They're packing food for maybe a multi-week trip, and they're going to be sending a mail drop ahead. And the last thing they want is for mold to be growing on their food. And that would be the downside. If you hadn't dried it well enough, then the risk is mold growth, and you definitely don't want that.
Yeah,
but it's not that hard. It's really not that hard.
So let's dive into some of these different categories, types of food, and staples that might go into ingredients. We talked a bit about meat previously. You mentioned with the ground meat, obviously avoiding things like fat, even sopping up some of that once it's cooked, adding the breadcrumbs. Those are critical aspects for sure. What other types of meat can be used for dehydrated meals? I'm thinking, that there's like the canned shredded chicken out there, and I know that it's possible to dehydrate those, but things can also be a little bit technical there. I think there's some specific tips that you have, or any other meat dehydrating techniques that come to mind, not jerky, but for actual meals.
You can use deli meat from the deli. Of that category, the one I primarily use just to give the variety of different meats into my menu for a trip would be ham. It's going to be low fat already, and it's going to be well preserved. So it's just a matter of drying it. So you buy it sliced thin, and then you just cut it into smaller strips and lay them on the dehydrator. It's fairly crispy, and in a meal, it's going to be fairly chewy, dehydrated deli ham. But I like that aspect of it in a lot of meals. I like to have that little bit of chewiness. So I use that. It's very simple to dry it. It goes great in, if you wanted to just make some macaroni and cheese with vegetables and ham, it's a great meal and real simple. As far as the ground beef goes, You want to stick with lean ground beef about the lowest you can buy, I think, is 7%. But in the 7 to 10% range, just make sure it's labeled lean. You don't want to go with the high-fat ground beef. And the same thing goes for ground turkey or ground chicken. You can use those as well and just use that breadcrumb technique, and it'll turn out well. As far as chicken goes, it's a tricky little meat. I've gotten the best results actually out of using canned chicken, or the chicken that you buy pre-cooked that's in the pouches. And I believe it has something to do with the retort cooking or pressure cooking that it's subjected to. But if you work with that, it rehydrates well in a meal. But now if you cook the chicken in the normal ways, like baking it or grilling it, it tends to be very dried out, and it doesn't rehydrate very well in a meal. It stays pretty hard. It's not very enjoyable. So I have so pretty much gone with canned chicken. I am working. I'm still perfecting it, and I think it's going to be a great new addition to dehydrating meat is marinating the chicken in a starch-based marinade. I'm working with cornstarch, and my experiments are very promising right now. And somehow or another, that, and also using salt, that cornstarch is getting into the meat. And so I'm still perfecting that before I publish it, but probably that'll be a good solution coming up. Other meats are, I dehydrate tuna. You know, tuna's a great addition to a meal. And shrimp is great. I love to have, make some shrimp linguine for my trail meals. It's delicious. And pretty much shrimp. I just generally buy the pre-cooked and frozen shrimp, and I'll just slice it into smaller pieces and hit it with a little bit of bay seasoning to give it a little extra flavor. And it dries real crispy, and it rehydrates quite well. So that's a good one for meals. And, you know, you can add it to all kinds of things. And the other meat that I like is crab meat. I buy the imitation crab meat, and that dries nice and crispy, and it rehydrates extremely well too. I think because part of the ingredients in it is a form of starch. So you can get a lot of variety, a lot of different meats to make all kinds of meals.
Man, there's some good things that I want to try now. I've done a ton of ground meat. I've even done, there's been times where we'll have like leftover pulled pork, and I'm like, I could just break this up pretty fine and give that a shot. And that's actually worked out decently well. Combining that with a starch as well. But yeah, things like deli meat and the shrimp, those are things I haven't tried. So I'll have to start some experimenting of my own. That's cool. Let's talk about the starches specifically. There's kind of a bunch of categories here we can get into, but I want to make sure we hit rice, pasta, and then potato as well, and techniques or strategies for those, because I think those are all critical elements that pair well with the meats we just talked about and can really make a meal much more hearty. So let's start with rice. Any specifics there you want to mention?
Yeah, the thing about rice, of course, you can always just pack instant rice and include it in your meal, and it just, you just have to add the hot water, and it's going to perform quite well in the meal. You would not want to use regular rice that would normally have to simmer for, say, 20 minutes, because that's going to use up too much fuel on the trail. So what I do is I pre-cook the rice and dehydrate it, and that way it basically turns it into instant rice, which rehydrates quickly on the trail. Now, the beautiful thing about pre-cooking your rice is that you can add the flavors to the rice, and so I kind of think ahead what I'm going to pair that rice with, what type of meat. And so I will cook that rice in either chicken, beef, or vegetable broth. And generally, all of these are either fat-free or extremely low-fat broths, which you can just buy at the grocery store. And so all that flavor goes into the rice while you're cooking it, and then it's really easy to dehydrate it. You just cook it normally, spread it out on the dehydrator trays. You'd need to use a nonstick sheet so it doesn't fall through. And it dries very quick and very crispy and hard, and rehydrates well. So the big thing about rice is that you can add those flavors. You know, if you want to add soy sauce or just, you know, any way you want to go with it, you can add that flavor to the rice. And it's a great flavor carrier.
Yeah, I definitely picked up the tip of using broths from your ideas, and it's awesome. It's great. I mean, just... it's amazing how good of a meal you can have in the backcountry by just doing simple things like that.
Exactly. And the same goes for potatoes. If you want to go with mashed potatoes, it would be the same way. You can boil your potatoes and then put them in the blender with the broth, just enough to thin them out. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a smoothie consistency. You spread that out on your dehydrator trays, very thin. The thinner, the better. You're going to get better results the thinner you spread that out. And so your flavor is in the potato. Same thing as the rice. And I call that bark.
When you're spreading that thin and then drying it.
Yeah, you want to spread it thin. If you don't spread it thin, you may end up, when you're rehydrating it on the trail, it may not break down completely into mashed potatoes. You may have some potato pieces, little thin potato pieces, which are tasty and good. There's nothing wrong with them, mm-hmm. but it might not all go back into a sauciness.
Yeah. So I've done the potatoes, used your approach of kind of blending those and spreading those thin, and then you just basically break that into the pieces, which is the bark.
Yeah. It's brittle.
Yeah, it's very brittle. Is there any a benefit to taking that? Because I've tried it both ways, just these bark chunks, if you will, and then I've also taken the bark and then thrown it back into a food processor and broken it up and almost powderized it a bit more for the rehydration. Is there any benefit to doing that? Does it just kind of provide a different consistency when it's rehydrated?
As far as rehydration, I haven't really found much difference or much advantage of either way. One thing, it would reduce volume. So if space is an issue, then you could powder it, and it'll take up less space in the packaged meal. It might rehydrate a bit better. One other thing, if you're vacuum sealing your meals or your daily rations, sometimes that bark, particularly potatoes, since it is very brittle, it may puncture your bags, and that would blow your seal. So that could be a reason that you might want to powder it, but I don't. I leave it as just the little pieces of bark.
Okay, perfect. How about pastas? Mm-hmm. Any specific things you do there? And then I know there's just kind of sticking with starches. We've done the rice, the potatoes. I'd love to talk about pasta. And then couscous is another thing that tends to be pretty popular on the trail. Mm-hmm. Give us some ideas or techniques for those types of things.
Yeah. When I started out, I was just using the macaroni from a box of macaroni and cheese. And I was using it as is right from the box in my meals, not pre-cooking or dehydrating it. And I found, as long as I the meal sizes weren't too large, that as long as I excuse me, as long as I brought the meal to a boil for at least 2 minutes, followed by putting the pot into a pot cozy, basically a little insulated sleeve for the pot that holds the heat in, that the macaroni would cook just fine in the meal as is. But later, when I started backpacking more with my wife, and our serving sizes got larger, and I wanted to use less fuel, I decided to start pre-cooking the macaroni in any pasta and then dehydrating it. And doing that then your cook time on the trail is down to a minute or less. Basically, you have to bring it to a boil and keep it hot. And so it behaves better if you pre-cook it and dehydrate it. And it's very fast. It dries very fast. Within 6 hours, it's dry. So you can use pretty much any kind of macaroni you want. You might want some, you know, if you want to just get by with using a spoon, then you might think about the size that you're dehydrating so that it fits on a spoon. But the only thing that's I found to be helpful is to cook it al dente so that it's a bit firm. And then once you've cooked it, I'm talking about in your kitchen at home, is to rinse it with cold water. And that will stop the cooking, and it'll rinse off a bit of starch. And so when you spread that on your dehydrator trays, it won't stick together. So it's a lot easier to spread it around if you've rinsed it.
With these starches, the rice, the pasta, the potatoes, are they all pretty pretty consistent with the temperature range that you should be dehydrating these at? And what is that temperature?
125 will generally do it. 135 will speed it up. No harm done if you want to go at 135. It'll just speed it up a little bit. So that's the range. And, you know, there are no hard and fast rules, really, as far as that goes. Sometimes I dry mixed loads in the dehydrator, you know, some vegetables and some starches, even maybe a meat, and I'll just kind of average the temperature, and it all works out.
Yeah, it's pretty forgiving. That's what I've found. I mean, I've done fruit at 115, and I've done it at 135. And as you mentioned, obviously going higher can speed up the process. But there's also been times where I had done something previously that took, say, 6 hours. And I was like, oh, I want to throw this in tonight and then not touch it till the morning. And so I'll just literally turn the temperature down a bit and then have a longer dryer time because it's just running overnight. And that works out fine, too.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned something about the pasta and then rinsing that in the cold water to stop the cooking, which made me think of that discussion we had earlier for things like chili or even things like the cooked ground beef. Should those be fully cooled from cooking temperature and maybe, you know, rested at room temperature before you begin that dehydrating process?
It's not necessary at all. Generally, when I do just straight up ground beef, I'll just let it cool enough. You know, I'll hit it. I'll pat it dry with a paper towel. But as long as it's cool enough to work with, I put it straight in the dehydrator. I don't let it sit around at all. Now with chili, as you know, leftovers sometimes taste better than the first night you cooked it. So there's no harm done at all in cooking your chili and putting it in the fridge overnight. And it just seems to blend the flavors even more. And, you know, that can be part of your strategy to have that kind of out of the way and waiting in the wings. And then you could put that in the dehydrator the next day with other things. You can refrigerate the chili and other things like that to kind of blend those flavors a little more.
Yeah. So we talked about the potato bark and kind of, you know, blending that, spreading it thin and making this bark. You can do the same thing with sauces. So give us some idea on things like tomato sauce now that's in a bark form or some other sauces or additives we could add to these meals.
Yeah. Well, tomato sauce is so simple. You don't have to be a cook. You know, if you've got a nice sauce that tomato sauce that you make yourself, that's great. But you can also just buy the jarred variety and use that. If it's got a lot of chunks in it, you might want to run it through the blender to make it all consistent. And then you can always add back your vegetables into the meal. You can add dried vegetables back into the meal. But as far as the sauce, it's going to dry perfectly uniform if you've kind of blended those chunks of tomato or carrots, whatever might be in there, into one unified sauce. And again, you want to avoid the cheesy type of sauces. So that's really easy. It's going to be what's called leather, so it's more pliable. You just spread it as thinly as you can on your nonstick sheets. And what I try to do once it's almost dry is I'll try to peel it off the nonstick sheet and then flip it over on another tray without a nonstick sheet, and that just finishes it off. And so if you wait till it's substantially dry, it's going to be fairly easy to peel it off the nonstick sheet.
Yeah, that's a good tip of then flipping it onto another tray that doesn't have that stick sheet and maybe some more airflow to finish
it. Works well for tomato sauce. It works fine. Won't work for some of the other barks. They'll just chip off. But with tomato sauce, it's easy to peel off. Another thing that I do a lot is what I call bean bark, which you can use any type of bean. One of the ones I like for a meal is just vegetarian baked beans, and basically just run them through a blender and spread it out thinly on your dehydrator trays, and it's got all that wonderful flavor in there. And so when you combine that in a meal with ground beef and rice and whatever vegetables you want to add, I like just like mixed vegetables for that. And that bean bark will just dissolve into a really delicious sauce. So it just kind of carries the whole meal. So you can do a lot with beans. You can use any kind. You can add, say, Mexican seasonings and create, an enchilada flavored meal or a taco flavored meal, and just combine that with the ground beef and the vegetables and whatever starch. And so bean bark is one of my favorite things to dry. You can do it with corn as well. You can come up with like a creamed corn sauce, and I like to combine that with the crab meat.
Yeah, that what you just mentioned, kind of like this enchilada taco inspired meal's been one of my favorites, but I hadn't done the bean bark. I had dehydrated black beans just whole, and then done, I had cooked ground beef with the breadcrumbs and taco seasoning or fajita seasoning, and then done rice, black beans, bell peppers. Like that's one of my go-to meals for sure. But I'll have to try that with actually blending those beans and then doing going that route, because I could see how that would provide some good consistency there.
Yeah, good consistency. Also protein. Having all that bean sauce in there is going to increase the nutritional value of the meal.
So we've mentioned vegetables a few times. Let's get into those a bit more specifically and kind of maybe cover some categories. I know we talked a bit about bell peppers, and I've done those quite a bit. But traditional things, vegetables that come to mind in terms of things like broccoli. I mean, if those, how do we dehydrate those? What's the approach? How are we preparing them or cutting them to dehydrate and then rehydrate well?
They're all pretty easy. Some of them I pre-cook before I dry them. Just light steaming is the way I usually do it. I'd say on average about 6 minutes of steaming. Some vegetables tend to take on a nicer color when steamed, and that would be true for the broccoli, and it's also true for carrots. They get darker, and they hold that darkness better. And visual is a big part of your trail meal. You can look in there and you see these bright colored vegetables, and you just feel good eating it. So some vegetables benefit from being steamed, but most can also be dehydrated raw as well. But broccoli is one that I steam. Corn is another, unless it's already been somehow pre-cooked before you buy it. But I don't recommend canned corn. It just doesn't seem to work out very well. I generally use frozen or fresh corn off the cob. Hmm. Yeah. But with broccoli, your florets are going to look better over time in the meal if you cook the starches or the stalks. And you maybe peel them a little bit. For some reason, they tend to brown up over time, so they're not as visually appealing in the meal. So if you just want that broccoli color, you might want to just stick with the florets. Let's see, what else? Carrots, one thing I've started doing, you know, obviously you can just kind of peel them and slice them across. They shrink up quite a bit when they're dehydrated. The way I cut them normally now is to cut them into longer pieces, almost like julienne style. And I like that shape in the meal. And they're longer, mm-hmm. about an inch and a half long. So you cut the carrot about an inch and a half up to 2 inches, say, long, and then slice that the long way several times, and you get it's just nice in a meal.
Yeah. Moving on from vegetables, just fruits. So there's a few approaches here. You know, fruits are something that I'm obviously not typically throwing in a meal, but or make great snacks. And so I'll do things right, like just sliced apples. But then there's the idea of making fruit leathers as well, which is really something I haven't dove into. But is that simply a matter of kind of making some sort of puree from the fruit and then drying that?
It is. It is. The main one that I do is just applesauce. So I'll generally cook that on the stove, maybe throw in a second fruit, possibly season it up with a little bit of cinnamon, maybe a tad of sugar. I like it cooked first, and then cool it, run it through the blender, and spread it thin on the trays. And you know, it's just a nice little treat to have, say, for a dessert. It's just to have some applesauce, and you can eat it cold or you can eat it hot on the trail, depending on your mood. Mm-hmm. It's real easy to dehydrate. It's leathery when you dry it, and typically you'll just tear it into pieces. One thing with some of the fruit leathers, which can be a disadvantage as far as trail use, if you're vacuum sealing your food, the vacuum sealing will put a little bit of pressure and crunch down your rations. And that fruit leather tends to stick together. And it's really hard, if it's been under pressure for a while, it can be really difficult to pull it apart. So you have this like big baggie of fruit leather all stuck together. So it takes a little more effort to end up eating it. You can kind of roll it up with plastic wrap so that it's not like touching itself to kind of alleviate that problem. I do applesauce, and I do pumpkin pie. Those are my two favorites. So basically you can make pumpkin pie. It's really pumpkin pudding. It's not really a pie. So I call it pumpkin pie pudding. Basically, you just take a can of pumpkin and you add your pumpkin pie seasonings, and you don't have to cook that at all. You can just spread it thin on your dehydrator trays, and it's real easy to rehydrate on the trail, and you can have it hot or you can have it cold.
Yeah, I would imagine that mixing in some like nuts or granola with that would make a fantastic snack / dessert.
It is. And it's really, really healthy. You can just have little pieces of pumpkin pie bark. I say it goes in like a chip and down like pie. So you kind of have to leave it in your mouth a little while to get that full pumpkin pie flavor. So it's something you can kind of chew on for a while.
Yeah.
Another one that's good to dry that makes a good snack or a pudding is sweet potatoes. So you can cook them and sweeten them up or season them with a little cinnamon, run them through the blender, and that makes a terrific and really healthy snack. And it's very chewy, so it's a very satisfying snack. Or you can rehydrate it back into mashed sweet potatoes. That's another nice one.
Yeah, I'm going to have to play with that. I've done sweet potatoes kind of with the mashed potatoes approach, but these ideas of this, you know, kind of pumpkin pie and kind of a sweet potato pudding, the applesauce, I'm going to have to play with that more for sure, because it would be awfully nice to kind of have a little sweet treat out there that's, you know, not just junk out of a plastic wrapper.
Right. Now, you along the fruit topic. I hardly ever eat dried fruit anymore when I'm hiking. I use it in a lot of things. So I like oatmeal in the morning. It's one of my favorites. It's nice, hot, and filling. So I'll add, typically apples, dried apples to the oatmeal. So it's rehydrating in the oatmeal. Generally, I'll boil the water for the oatmeal with the apples in the water, so to get the rehydration started, and then add the oatmeal, and so you've got all that combined. But what I like to do with dried fruit for the rest of the day is I've started carrying a thermos food jar, and in the afternoon, well, first of all, I make my lunch for the day in the morning. So I'll add the dried meal to the thermos and add the boiled water and then seal it up. And that way I can eat lunch wherever and whenever I want. Doesn't matter about the weather. I don't have to cook. I can just enjoy the meal. But after I've eaten my lunch and cleaned out the thermos with just a few swirls of water, I add the dried fruit and cold water. Hopefully I've stopped to eat my lunch at a nice cold spring. But add the cold water and just seal it up. And then, late in the afternoon, especially in the summer, when you're tired and it's hot out, you just open that thermos. And I overhydrate that. So if I stuck a cup of dried fruit in there, I'll add 2 cups of water. And what you end up with is what I call fruit cocktail. And so you can sip off about half of that water, and it's just juicy and delicious and refreshing late in the afternoon. And then you just eat that fruit, and it's like eating, fruit. It's not dried fruit. It's nice and rehydrated, and it's just a wonderful snack. It's kind of a reward late in the day when you've been, hiking, say, 10, 15 miles. It keeps you going until you get to your campsite and maybe another couple miles out.
That is an awesome idea. I really like that. I've never.
I'm a big fan of the thermos now, I continue to find new uses for it.
Yeah, I was just gonna say I've never thought of as well. Kind of, if you're already making boiling water for oatmeal and things like that in the morning, of then using that to then add to a meal for that midday time, and then keeping that in a thermos. Obviously, I know some thermoses can get incredibly heavy, so you'd have to kind of keep an eye on that if you're on a long trip and didn't want to carry, something incredibly heavy there in terms of the device.
Yeah, you have to decide if it's worth carrying. And for me, absolutely worth carrying. I get so much enjoyment at what I can do with the thermos. It's the 24-ounce thermos food jar weighs a little under a pound.
Okay.
And so if you're willing to carry one extra pound, you can get a great deal of utility. And the reason I went to it was I used to cook all my – I like a hot lunch. And so I used to actually cook at lunchtime. And, for me, it was the time to take a break, take my boots off. But sometimes the weather just doesn't cooperate, and you don't want to cook in the rain or whatever reason. Some days you just don't want to cook. So having it all ready to go is wonderful. And then also, if you still got a long way to go, it's already late in the day, you might cook your dinner late in the afternoon. And so all you have to do when you get to your campsite is open a thermos and eat. And another advantage of that would be, you're not putting out any cooking odors if you're concerned about bears or anything like that.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Something I've never thought of, for sure. I did want to talk a bit about kind of the cooking and rehydrating. And there's kind of, just to oversimplify things, there's sort of two approaches. One would be to actually rehydrate that meal by cooking it. So you're adding some of the ingredients with the water into a pot and heating it all together.
Right.
And then what I've done most often was just boiling water, add to the dried ingredients, and wait. What things don't work well with just this add boiling water approach?
I think I think what you're referring to, what a lot of people do, is like freezer bag cooking.
Yeah, container cooking, freezer bag cooking. Yeah,
any kind of container, right? Any kind would work. A lot of people like the freezer bag approach because they can just reseal the bag and put it in with their disposables. Pretty much with container cooking, you might want to allow for a little bit more time for rehydration, because when the hot water hits the food, it's going to cool down a little bit. Rather than if you sustain the temperature in a pot for, say, a minute while it boils. So you might want to add at least another 5 minutes to your rehydration time. It'd be very important to insulate your container with one thing you can use is this Reflectix material. It's basically like a real thin bubble wrap with foil on either side. So if you're using a bag, you make a pouch, or the container, you make it to fit whatever container you're using. And the one thing for sure would be the pasta. It won't work with that method unless you pre-cook and dry it. So that's the main item that you would have to alter.
Yeah, but most items, if they're pre-cooked, dehydrated, they're going to work. It's just going to take a bit longer versus reheating in the pot with water that's boiling and then maintained.
Right. Yeah. My method is to combine the food and the water and just kind of let it sit for just 5 minutes. That just gets things going a little bit. And with dehydrated food, there's no need to what I call rush the boil. You don't need a stove that's going to boil water in 3 minutes. The whole time period of when the water is going from just room temperature, you could say, up to boiling, that's all good time to help the meal rehydrate. So basically, let it sit for 5 minutes, light your stove. Maybe within 6 minutes, you're boiling, and then you could shut your stove off then, or you could let it go another minute, and that will improve your results. But you could shut it off at any time there, and then you transfer your pot to a pot cozy, and it surrounds the pot all around, bottom, top, and it holds the heat in and just keeps that process going. And generally within 15 minutes, you've got a delicious meal that's well rehydrated.
I'd like to talk a little bit about packaging and storage. I guess let's just start with whole meals. So we've either pre-made this meal and then dehydrated it, or we have multiple separate dried ingredients that we've now packaged into a meal. How do you package things for the trail to make sure that they stay good, and then that, they're small and not taking up too much volume? You mentioned vacuum seal earlier. Is that something you do to save space, or is vacuum seal required to keep the food items good for longer? Talk us through that.
Yeah, I definitely use a vacuum sealer. I use it at home as well as for the meals that go out to the trail. At home, I use a vacuum sealer in conjunction with a wide mouth mason jar food sealer. It's a little accessory. So as I'm drying individual ingredients, I can put them in the jar, and then this little accessory just slides over the top. And it sucks out all the air from the jar and seals it. So that's a great way of staging individual items, particularly if you're interested in keeping those available for just home storage. So I do that at home. But as far as packaging for the trail, if you're just going out for the weekend or even a week, you don't need to vacuum seal your food. It may still have some advantages for you if you do, but as far as the dried food going bad or anything like that, it's not really necessary. It's gonna last just fine. But what I do, and because some trips may be a month long, and I'm doing mail drops and everything, I want my food to be well secured. So I do vacuum seal. The way I do it is I pack the individual meals and snacks and everything in Ziploc bags, just the minimal size that will accommodate the meals. And then if at all possible, I put all of that into one vacuum seal bag, the larger size. And I actually use the rolls and cut the size that I need. And so that would be what I call my daily rations. It's all vacuum sealed into one pack. And that way I can keep all my food well organized in my pack just by day, so I can just open the one day at a time. And it does scrunch the food down so that it doesn't take up a whole lot of space. Another advantage to having those rations vacuum sealed is that at night, you're hanging your food generally to keep it safe from bears. So it's going to be perfectly fine out in the weather. It's going to be separated from any kind of moisture if it's vacuum sealed. And of course, that would also be a big advantage if you're going on a canoe or kayak expedition. So that's why I do the vacuum sealing.
What are your thoughts on longer term storage? You kind of mentioned using the mason jars and then vacuum sealing those, which is great. But just an average, maybe a meal that you've assembled, and that's either been maybe vacuum sealed, dehydrated yourself. What kind of shelf life do you stick to with that, if any?
Well, I really believe in eating what I produce and not storing it forever. I've eaten meals well over a year after I dried and vacuum sealed them. So that's pretty much what I say. You know, you can go out a year. As somebody who publishes information, I don't want to go out too far and promise right. things and then somebody say, oh, you know, I got sick because you told me it would last 2 years. And, you know, so I'm a little cautious there. But you probably could go longer. But I like to actually consume the food that I'm drying. So I try to use it up within a year or even, you know, just within the range of a trip. But it will keep, and vacuum sealing will help keep it longer. Some vegetables will tend to start to lose their color. They might brown up a little bit. Corn is one of those that kind of tends to turn a little brownish over time. And so I try to use it up within a year. But mainly, you know, you want to keep it safe and separated from air and moisture and possibly even light. So you want to keep it in a cupboard that will separate it from the sunlight of your windows.
Before we wrap up here, Glenn, I'm just curious, what have been some of the most popular recipes? Because, you have a bunch of recipes on your site for all different types of meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert, snacks, everything. What are some of the go-tos, the most popular things that you would want to make sure people check out because they might enjoy them?
Sure. Well, we already discussed chili, and my recipes, it's a very basic chilies, and I know everybody probably has their own type, which is great. Just, chili, some people like to add a lot of heat to it. And so chili, either my recipe or the one you want to doctor it up with, is a great choice. Another one of my favorites is what I call unstuffed peppers, which I make as an assembled meal. I dry the rice, the ground beef, the bell peppers, and the tomato sauce all separately. And, of course, the reason I do that is because I use all those ingredients in other types of meals as well. But when they come together, those particular items as unstuffed peppers, it's really delicious. And, it's just it just feels like a home-cooked meal. It's something that my mother used to make when I was a kid, and I always loved it. So, it just gives you that kind of a feel-good feeling when you're out, in the woods at night eating your unstuffed pepper. So I like that one. As I said, a lot of the ones like with the bean bark adds a great sauciness to any meal with rice. You can add beef or beans, and it's delicious. The mac and cheese, I think mac and cheese is probably, a favorite of a lot of people. And you can make it so many different ways. Basically, you can use the cheese sauce and carry powdered milk. to make the macaroni sauce, the cheese sauce, and then you can add just any kind of meat you want to it. It works well with tuna, works well with ham, works well with ground beef, and then also alter the vegetables that you choose. So you can make so many different meals with that. And, you know, adding, say, taco seasoning makes a really tasty meal with ground beef. So that's a good one. Any of the potatoes, the same thing with the mashed potatoes. And I like that with ham, but I also like it with ground beef and just, you know, mixed vegetables. That's just a few of it off the top of my head.
Yeah, for sure. So your site's backpackingchef.com. Besides the listeners going and checking that out, is there any other places or resources that you would like to tell us about?
Well, that's the main home. You can buy the book either, you know, you can visit the website to buy it. It's Recipes for Adventure. It's sold on Amazon. I've got a Facebook page. You can find that through the website as well, but it's Backpacking Chef. And that's the main thing. I do put out a monthly newsletter called Trail Bites, and you can sign up for that newsletter on the website. Once a month, I send out one of my experiments. So with the readers, I like to kind of share the whole process of what I'm trying to work out. And I think the readers enjoy seeing kind of a firsthand look at how I'm trying to develop something. So, you know, each month I generally provide some sort of a recipe or a trip report.
Great. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, that is a wrap on this one. Again, be sure to check out backpackingchef.com for recipes and more information. It has been a resource that I have relied on quite a bit over the last couple years, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So thanks to Glenn for putting that together and for sharing his knowledge on this show. Again, you can contact us directly with comments, questions, or suggestions to podcasts@exomountaingear.com. And don't forget, we have that free backcountry fuel guide at exomountaingear.com/nutrition. Catch you guys next week.